Welcome to another episode of the Evolution Exchange podcast. Today, I'm joined with three really interesting panel members to discuss the topic of cybersecurity, navigating new threats and innovations. This is something that I know is really important at the minute and really interesting to a lot of the people within my network, within the security space that I've spoken with. So I'm super excited to have the panelists here with me discussing this. So I'm going to ask for each of you to introduce yourself so our listeners can hear what you sound like before we get into the conversation. And for this, I'd love you to let me know who you are, what you do, and what you're passionate about. So, Neil, we'll start with you if you want to introduce yourself first.
Thank you. Yes, I'm Neil Hindocha. I'm the Chief Security Officer for Surfboard Payments. And Surfboard Payments is a company that has a platform for payments for cloud-connected terminals, online payments, as well as SoftPOS. And I've been with the company in one way or another since it started, and helped build up the security around the payments infrastructure. And my interests, I have three kids, so I have very little time for interests. But if I get a chance, I fall back to gaming. I have to honestly say that's passion that I've had most of my life. So that's what I like to do.
Oh, nice. What's kind of your favorite game?
Just started on Diablo 4. So that's the current one. And I actually play with my boys sometimes. So then they play Fortnite. But it's not really my game. It's just fun to play together.
Yeah, nice. Kind of killing two birds with one stone, having family time and gaming as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, brilliant. Thanks, Neil. And Barry's coming over to you for your intro.
Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for having me. I'm Baris. I'm the VP and CISO of Truecaller. We are, you know, a global spam and fraud blocking application with, I mean, over 374 million monthly active users. So we have an extremely large digital footprint that I'm responsible of protecting. But that's what I do. My passions are exactly the same as Neil's. I do have two daughters, 6 and 3, so they're not really ready to game with me yet, especially the bloody games that I play, the competitive type of games that I play, Apex being my favorite as of right now.
Oh, nice. No, good to have some passions in common there. Thanks, Baris. And finally, Bernard, coming over to you for your intro.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Bernard Helou. I am cybersecurity manager for Schibsted Media. So Schibsted Media provides newspaper and media content podcasts in the Nordics, mainly in Norway and Sweden, where we are the largest newspaper in these countries. My passion is, yeah, so I have two small kids as well. So when I'm not running after them or spending time along, I try to play in the bandy. So it's like indoor hockey on foot, right? There's no ice, so it's much more accessible. And I fell into that some years ago when I was, let's keep it to some years ago when I was studying. I kept doing that. Now a bit less, unfortunately, but looking forward to get back to it.
Oh, nice. No, thank you. And yeah, thank you all, I suppose, for joining me on the podcast when obviously family life, work life, it's busier than ever at this time. So do appreciate it. And I know that we're in for a good conversation.
Hi, everyone. This is Chris Bennett here, the Nordics Managing Director here at Evolution. We're committed to doing recruitment in a different way that adds value to both our clients and candidates by providing you with amazing speakers and leading-edge discussions on what's going on in the tech scene at the moment. There are three reasons why you should contact me. If you would like to speak on a future podcast, if you are interested in hiring awesome tech, data, product or gaming freelancers for your business, or if you are looking for an exciting new organization to work with, please get in touch. Thank you so much for listening, and I really hope to hear from you soon. Please enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Now that we've got the feel of everyone, we'll move on to the topics in focus, which I know myself, Baris, Bernard, Neil, we all talked about before this podcast of what we were going to discuss. And there's some really, really interesting topics. So let's just dive straight into them. And we'll start with yours, Baris, which was, what do we foresee being top focus areas for CISOs in the upcoming years? So, yeah, tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. I mean, I never want to miss the opportunity to ask these questions when I'm talking to peers from different sectors and industries. You know, it gets, I can't say it gets lonely, but, you know, you get stuck in your own thoughts, and you look at your strategy and your outlook for the upcoming years, and you might become a little bit of home blind. That's why I think this is a great opportunity to ask Neil and Bernard this type of question. What do you foresee being a top focus areas for the future? And, you know, with the topic of this podcast, new threats and innovation, I think that's all about the future and, you know, preparing yourself for that. That's why I wanted to bring this topic up. And I can speak a little bit of, you know, what's been on my agenda, but more importantly, what I want to master in the upcoming years, hence being my focus. And I think that will be, you know, embracing automation and security operations fully. I think that will be the thing I want to master the most, as the benefits in from a resource management perspective is, you know, the unprecedented. If I can have my people not work with manual, tedious tasks, not only may I be able to lower my FT headcount, but more importantly, I can have my, you know, my SecOps people working on the things that they are passionate about rather than the must-dos. So I've been investing early now in, you know, some of these automation platforms and trying to figure out how to make this work. But I think this is something that I will be, you know, indulging in quite a bit in upcoming two to three years. Have any of you guys been dabbling in the security automation field?
Well, that echoes, right? Automation is always something we're eager to do. Try to remove low-hanging fruits and have the machines do them automatically for us so that the teams can focus on kind of added value. And I think that we're in a period in the world where it's a lot of new things coming that can support as well automation, right? One of the things is around AI. That is a huge topic. I mean, that's the two letters we've seen everywhere that are being used for everything and anything. Back in the days, for those who've been in cybersecurity for some years now, it's always been about machine learning, etc. Now it's moving into AI and facilitating code and security. So I see that integration as really coming. We'll probably touch upon that a bit later in the podcast. But this is definitely one of the topic I envisioned.
Yeah.
I agree on the automation side. I think it's operations. I think it can be very heavy on personnel, but if you automate it right, you can really make it more efficient. But I also think automation has a place in an SDLC, for example. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of parts we can automate before, you know, you release the code, and I think that has a lot of value as well. So I think automation as an area is really interesting. And I've been testing out actually doing automated threat modeling on mm-hmm. architectural diagrams, and I must say I was very impressed with how well that the output is coming back. And I think that, you know, if you get it to work to not that automation does everything, but if you can move it into self-service so that an architect can use your the tool that you built and get output back that they can directly act on themselves. So I think automation together with like the self-service concept is also something I've been looking at, because I see, you know, if you work with security, the other departments internally are kind of your customers. They're kind of mm-hmm. the ones you put requirements on, and that you have to interface with and work with. So I think that there's a self-service concept as well that would be important in the future. So you don't need specialized security people to interpret the tool output and then provide it back. You can just automate that part of it. So yeah, automation, I think, in many areas, and obviously combined with AI, like the automated threat modeling tools and some other things. And also think, depending on the industry, in that regulation is going to be an important one. I mean, just this and next year, we have DORA, NIS2, CER. There's so many of them coming in at this point that it's almost hard to keep up. So I think that's another focus area for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think automation can be a tool in helping gather evidence for compliance purposes for just those regulatory frameworks that we have to be on top of.
And one of the things that automation requires is good integration as well, right? So you ensure that you have a complete overview of what you need to automate to take the right decision based on the right input. If you're missing half of them, then the decision might not be the right one. But yes, it's one of an important topic, but that can turn into quite complex if you have heavy IT infrastructure, etc.
Definitely. Look, it's easy for me to say, like, introduce security automation because, Truecaller, we are, we GCP native. We use a lot of, the well-known SaaS vendors, and we kind of, textbook TechCrunch type of organization where it's almost laid out for us what to, it's easy to automate. We don't have a large complex IT environment, which helps a lot in that sense.
I like to add maybe two topics also that I see coming on top of AI automation things. And you kind of touched upon them, Baris, when you mentioned that it's cloud environment, SaaS, etc. The first one is around third-party management, right? We have seen recently through the world events that breaches often happen for big companies because of their providers. And that starts to be more and more an issue for major companies because maybe it has been a bit of easy trust with providers. And now we need to take it to kind of the next step. And that ties also to my next point, which is the mindset is not about whether or not we're going to be hit by a cyber incident, but when is it going to happen? So resilience become really crucial, right? Because we see, just yesterday, a couple of days ago, Google, Facebook was down, Instagram, everything. That's so even them have troubles, and that doesn't become a matter of if that's going to happen or not, but what do we do if that happens, right? It's just starting to take the next step into recovery. We're not talking anymore about how do we set up our firewall to protect ourselves. Is how do we get up if we're down?
Yeah, and it's so hard to control. I mean, with that specific incident, how many other services were affected by not being able to log in via Meta or Google in that? Couldn't log into their app because Google was down. And, those aggregated effects are, unforeseeable. But yes, I mean, speaking from my perspective, I'm quite heavy into those dependencies as you describe them. It's sometimes nice to have a data center where you can, you can hug the rack and you can spray some clean air into the fans of your servers and make sure that they are okay. But when you take decisions as we have done to, depend on others for our operations, it's almost quantifiable that you will have disruptions throughout the year if we just look at past events and it's undoubtedly going to happen, which we didn't necessarily say when we ran our own on-premises everything, because that was up to us to make sure it was up and running.
I think On the third party point, one of the things that is coming in more as well is the fourth party assessment. And you know, I've been subjected to that a few times now because of financial regulation on other companies. So they do an assessment, and so that assessment includes our third party assessment. So it goes one step further, and I think that's, you know, so I think fourth party assessments is something that's going to be more important, because as you say, breaches are coming through a third party. But then the fourth party needs to be protected as well, so that the whole chain gets strengthened. So I think that's really important. And also on the topic of recovery, I think that's one of the things I've seen where cloud platforms really help. I think that in some ways, even though you may not have the same control you have had in data center, also with all the automation and deployments that you can do, deployment scripts and you know, pipelines you can run, I think that if you do your setup right, it's also possible to recover fairly quickly in a cloud environment. So I think that's the benefit. You don't have to do the running around and resetting servers, and like, it's all there. So yeah, it's good and bad, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But tying to that, and that's kind of a thing that we don't see today yet. And that can be scary when you combine it with our technology, is the encryption, right? We're going to quantum computers, and that can crack any encryption. So basically, every security features, SSH, all the level of encryptions that we know today, can be almost instantly cracked tomorrow, and that's going to revolutionize cybersecurity. Or that's pretty scary when we think about it like that. So I don't know. There is no real time frame about it, but the day it comes, we'd better have thought it through. I feel. What are your thoughts about that, Annie?
Yes, I'm actually in. Some of the PCI working groups and the quantum resilient cryptographies is a topic that's come up a few times. But I have to be honest, I don't actually know. I feel that there's information going in different directions here, and we don't have the systems in place to do it right now. So yeah. So honestly, I don't actually know how this is going to go. I think that. I think that it's going to land somewhere in between. I don't think it's going to be able to, you know, break encryption immediately in that way. And I think there are things we're going to be able to do to mitigate against it that is not as extreme as swapping out the entire crypto algorithms. But again, I don't actually know. I think this is an interesting area to follow in the future and to also see how the development goes, you know, on quantum computers in general.
That's the future.
Exactly. I remember an ISF conference in Dublin. It was pre-corona, where quantum computing and security was a big, like, was one of the main themes, one of the five themes. But I feel like it's been put aside a little bit due to AI and that kind of hype, so we haven't talked about it as much. But I'm with Neil here. I know that I don't know enough to be able to speak on it.
Nice. No, thank you all for that. It was a really good topic, and definitely get a sense of it's forever changing, isn't it? And you've got to be ready to adapt for whatever is going to come in the future, or the future, like you said. So no, thank you. Really good topic to start us off there, Baris. And Bernard, coming over to yours, which is AI and cybersecurity. Who will be the fastest to exploit this technology, attackers or defenders? So yeah, great topic. Give us some more info on that.
Yeah, so AI, it's been so trendy and so huge communication about it. I mean, everyone, even my parents are like, oh, have you seen ChatGPT and everything? So if they know about technology, it means like everybody knows about it. And we can see all the businesses, right, taking the AI train. How can I use AI to perform better, to communicate better, to target better? And when you apply it for cybersecurity, right, same. It's, as I mentioned a bit earlier, many years ago, vendors were talking about how machine learning and their system learning patterns and all can facilitate cybersecurity, but it never exploded in automation, etc. And now with AI, I mean, it has been perverted into hacker tools, hacker GPT, and DDoS GPT or whatever GPT they have made around offensive security. And then I'm thinking, where is the defensive base? You know, where do companies stand around that? Because my first thought was like, the attackers, they try. If it fails, it fails. As a defender, if you fail, you're in a very bad position. So you have much more to lose. And meaning that defensive security needs to invest even more and be even better into exploiting AI. So this is kind of the trend of thoughts and trying to understand, because we have a lot of AI technology coming, but maybe the cybersecurity field hasn't yet moved so far, so fast on that train. What are your thoughts, Baris?
Yeah. I was sitting thinking here when I'm listening to you, what defensives, I mean, there's a lot of sales rep in my inbox that, you know, say that I have AI powered security solutions that will solve all my problems. But in reality, what have I experienced? I know, you know, we run a bug bounty program where we get a lot of, you know, get a lot of input from externals. And we have utilized Gen AI there to help us, you know, triage the incoming bounties, because there's a lot of, you know, nonsense that comes in in that. Other than that, you know, some of the tools we have become better in enriching, you know, vulnerability detections or threat detection with, you know, providing a more clear summary of, you know, what's been detected, what's the recommended outcome. I think those have become a little bit better, and they are supposed to be, you know, AI powered. That's how they come about. But in what I foresee being one of the major areas is, you know, help with behavior analytics of users within your environment to see if, you know, if they deviate a lot, and we could maybe see a brighter future for insider-related threats. That's something I would love to see, because I think that's an area where it's super hard to be, you know, if you intervene in an employee's workday, you make them a suspect, you know. But with AI, we take those, you know, those emotional aspects out of it, and you add like a robot, and that robot had drawn the conclusion that, you know, you have an elevated risk behavior, and that's why, you know, the CISO might call you. so that's on my wish list for anyone out there trying to develop the next cybersecurity tool to tell me.
I think just to bounce on what you said, Baris, what could be really cool and really good in AI, because you mentioned the user behavior, access authentication and all, that's something I also really much like in cybersecurity. But I would even take it to the next step, because this is just learning, right? Okay, what do you usually do? But with AI, we could even connect with, like, okay, this person is on holidays, and in his holiday sheet, he's supposed to be in Spain, but now he's trying to connect from, South Africa, which is strange. And then, like, this is much more, you can even maybe push it and make decisions based on actual events, moving events, right? Because it can actually have the ability to understand what's happening around. But yeah, that could definitely be pretty cool. But I feel that sometimes we're just being marketed and having AI branded when it's actually not so much AI in it.
It's more ML than anything. Yeah. Right. Yeah, you're completely right. And that will also help with the zero trust, you know, fancy to have those enrichments that you just talked about. You know, should we provide access? This person is stating that she's in Spain, but really the IP is from South Africa. We're going to deny the access now. Yeah,
I like the idea of user behavior monitoring, actually, and profiling. You know, creating a profile and then finding deviations from that. I think that's a really good way of using AI. I mean, as I mentioned in the beginning, my I personally used it for the threat modeling side. I was thoroughly impressed. I have to say, I was very impressed with the output. Its ability to read the diagrams and actually tell me what the different systems do just based on the name, and you know, asking the questions, and then it didn't take long to get valuable output. And I've used it quite a bit since. So I think that's a good use for it. The other thing I'm really fascinated with is these GPTs. So we have, for example, we have PCI compliance requirements. So sometimes you want to do something, you wonder, can I do this? Is there any requirement preventing it? Like, what do I need to adhere to here? And the GPT, there's a number of GPTs for PCI compliance, and you just ask the question, it gives you a perfect answer back. These are the requirements in your area. This is, you know, what they say. And my only fear is that if they're wrong, I would never know, because I'm not going through the 280 or whatever requirements they have to figure out if it's right or wrong. So that's my biggest fear with this, to be honest. But that part of it, I'm really liking the GPTs, where you can just ask questions like, you know, I want to use a self-signed certificate. Is that okay according to PCI DSS-4? And it gives a good answer back. So, yeah.
And that's where actually it becomes a bit scary, this edge, or how much can I trust the AI, its answers, and how much do I trust it in keeping my information safe, right? Because maybe at some point, Neil, you're going to tell AI, okay, so let's implement it like that. And how quiet and how secret will your secrets remain, and that not anyone of your colleagues can ask, okay, what did Neil tell you and how did we implement that? And then things just get out of hand.
It makes me think of, you know, when the GPS and Google Maps and Apple Maps and them were first released, and people driving to completely wrong places because they would just trust what the map is saying.
Right.
And I think that's exactly what's going to happen with the AI. And I think the only solution to that is to make the AI more accurate, because I don't believe people are going to change how they behave. So
that's part of the learning curve, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're saving so much time now, so we won't be looking back, right? But I wonder, Neil, what will you say if the auditors question you? How did you reach this conclusion?
Yeah, let's.
Who would you blame?
Let's hope they update the regulation so I can provide ChatGPT answers to auditor questions.
Yeah, that's true. Take it remotely.
No, the audit is still the audit. You know, you have to do it one requirement at a time and prove that you're following it. I think the phrase that is very popular, especially in PCI, is demonstrably in use. So you can say anything you want, but demonstrably in use. So that's the way to go.
But in defensive security, I think also we can use AI, hopefully, to be much faster in responding or reacting maybe to different events, right? Detecting suspicious, correlating with other places, and getting back to the previous thing, right? To the previous topic around how integrated your systems are as well, so that AI could properly take the different inputs and react accordingly. So,
Yeah, I think that really makes sense. I think that, like, one of the things that AI is doing, and it's been going that direction even before AI, is that it's just harder to get away with things. Like, before you could, if you go back a number of years, you could get away with not patching that quickly, even on basic systems. Now that's not going to happen. And I think that the more AI is used, the faster this is going to go, and the less you can get away with things. Like, if you don't have proper security, you will, you know, bad things will happen very, very fast. So that's going to be one of the immediate changes from when AI is used in the, you know, in the months or maybe year.
Well, maybe it could even patch for you.
Yeah, that's the other side of it.
Test first, if successful, in production.
I mean, we've had those threats, right, where they would penetrate a system using a vulnerability, and then they patch the vulnerability so no one else can come in. So that's wouldn't be the first time.
Brilliant. No, thank you. Thank you all for your input there. Good topic to follow on again. So thanks for that, Bernard. And yeah, really good conversation. Neil, your kind of topic or area was more on security in a multi-cloud environment. So yeah, tell us, your stand on that and what you want to bring to the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. So we've been running in a, we run our entire infrastructure in a cloud environment, and we've been looking at, or is something that we're doing actually, is that we're running it clustered in multiple cloud environments. So the idea is that if the entire, you know, say Google Cloud or AWS, or if one of them goes completely down, it shouldn't impact us at all. And it's been interesting because I think that that is something that's going to increase. I saw actually, I think it was just yesterday or a few days ago, where the cloud, various cloud environments, it was GCP first, and now it was AWS to remove the fees from moving from one cloud environment to another, the data fees. So, I mean, I think this is going to happen more. And I think that it's a way increasing your resilience. And I think that's going to be really important, as we saw just yesterday, that, you know, some of the large vendors went down. That is surprising. So I think multi-cloud is an interesting thing. So I think that multi-cloud is part of the future. But what I found interesting in doing this project is that a lot of the security means just getting the basics right. So what I found is, you know, if you don't have a proper handling on your access management, it becomes infinitely more difficult when you add new cloud environments on it. If you're not collecting your logs and putting them in properly, again, new type of logs, and you're not just adding one system, you're adding a whole bunch of things in one go. So just getting the basics in place has been an interesting challenge. You think you have it, but then you realize, well, actually, no, I didn't think of this scenario, that things here I need to change just to get it all running. And you have to run it, you know, in a uniform manner. So even though the implementation in different clouds is different, you have to get security running in a uniform manner, because you can't triple your staff. You can't say I have one staff dedicated to this cloud and one set of staff to this other one. You have to run everything in the same lane. So those are some of the challenges I found with trying to set up a multi-cloud environment. And I would love to hear your thoughts on it, and if there's anything, if you have any experience with this, or if you have any thoughts on what's important for security in this type of setup.
I think unifying monitoring, right? You don't want to monitor or have the tools dedicated for each cloud environment and then ending up with 2-3 different consoles to view what's happening, because then that kills your reactivity. That kills the correlation of data, or makes it much, much harder. It spreads the risk, right? Multi-cloud, if one goes down, I still have the other. And that's pretty cool. I would even consider multi-region, right? What happens if someone actually cuts cable and under the sea? Never know. But what's also interesting in that setup of multi-cloud is you need to test it as well, right? You said if I want to migrate from AWS to GCP, I won't do that in two clicks, right? So having multi-cloud environment on the paper sounds great, but how much of it I have tested that, so that I know that actually I would be faster to migrate from AWS to GCP than from AWS to, I don't know, AWS in the US, just to go away from Europe. Okay, it's different. And that's what's interesting, because that might even not be the same teams, right? It's different competence. I don't know. Any thoughts on it, Boris?
I'm trying to grasp the challenges here. I see the benefits really clearly, but I have so many questions. So, but are you still like prone to one cloud, and then you use the other ones as a, you know, a redundancy, or is the thought of, you know, mirroring the capabilities to each?
So the, because we're doing a transaction, so it's from credit card terminals, or it's card transactions. So the part of our environment that handles the first leg, which is the authorization request, that is running in multiple clouds. Everything else, then you have a lot of supporting things that aren't, you know, but so the thing is, if payments go down for 5 minutes, that's stores, and you know, there's a lot of stores that wouldn't be able to take payments. And you know, 20 minutes later you have queues building up, and then they're screaming at you at the phone. So the consequence in this type of environment, of in this type of product, to be down, it's significant because people are losing money, and then that's a direct impact and direct consequence in all areas. So the authorization side of it, the credit card authorizations, that runs multi-cloud. But then everything else runs in one cloud. So you have supporting systems that does, you know, calculations on payouts and all these different things that, you know, or you do checks on customers to make sure then, you know, you check against money laundering. There's all the other things that run that are critical by the second. So those don't run in multi-cloud. So it's one part of it that runs there. But it's been, I think, and because... I guess, I mean, the question is interesting because it brings in, you know, it makes you think of something else, like what is actually most important? And I would say that the most important thing in a payments company is to be available.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, definitely.
Yeah,
it makes sense and it's very impressive, I'd say. So in general, is, you know, the switch over between the clouds are done, you know, automatically, seamlessly. There's no intervention from your teams. Like if one is not responding in, you know, 3 or 4 seconds, you jump over to the other, or how does that
work? That's automation.
It's clustered. It's an active cluster.
Oh, cool.
So there is no switch over. Everything is up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
That's high availability.
Let's hope so. Knock on wood. I'd rather.
Exactly. That's so cool.
Yeah, indeed. But one challenge I see also is like the patching and the fixing, right? Because if you have an issue, you have to fix it basically on the three different instances, right? Because and that duplicates kind of the work.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's a really good point as well. So you have, this was the point that what I realized in this is that you have to get your basics right. So you have to get your deployment pipes working. It can't be that the deployment pipe is almost working, but I just need to go in and do that thing because that thing is something completely different in the next cloud and might not even be doable in the third one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to make it work. You have to get all the scripts working and you have to get the pipelines, you know, set up properly. That's what I meant with the basics, you know.
That must require quite good organization between the teams on the also the sprints or the roadmap they have, how to fix things. They need also to fix it the same way. And it might be different technologies, it might be different. So that's pretty interesting. Pretty challenging also, right? It must not be easy all the time.
I like to say that if I had known how complex payments are, I never would have entered it. So you don't do it because it's easy, you know. When you face with these, you realize all the things you have to comply with and all the scrutiny gets put on you. And as I said, you're down for a couple of minutes, and they'll call immediately. Mm. It's not like, oh, I'll get a coffee and then I'll try again. That is not the behavior. So, you know, it's a challenging area, but I can add that we don't integrate directly to any of the cloud services. So everything is running basically is running on Kubernetes and containers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fairly self-contained in that sense. And it was actually built. I mean, we had the benefit of the company it's about 5 years old. So we had the benefit of being able to build it on new tech, and we built it with this mindset from the beginning. I think, I don't know how it would be to convert something that's already in place. It'd probably be more challenging. So,
very interesting.
Brilliant. No, thank you for that. We've got 20 minutes left of the hour we set aside for this podcast. So now that we've kind of gone through the main topics we all suggested, we've definitely got time for some more. And I know I think it was Barry, we've already touched on automation in kind of your first one of being a top focus area for the future. But is there anything more on the topic of automation that would be worth exploring from anyone really?
I could just follow Neil a little bit about getting the basics right, because, you know, since we started focusing on automation, we realized, you know, the standard IT processes that, you know, you take for granted, but maybe never really up to par with what you really wanted them to be. We've really seen that, you know, utilizing automation in those areas are very effective, like, you know, account provisioning or device management and permission handling, that you can utilize, you know, automation to get that working quite effectively, but most importantly, make it easy for your employees to do right. You know, an example is that, you know, we are letting go of a system here that we are, you know, decommissioning, and that we pull, you know, whoever's an active account in that system, and then we by utilizing this low code platform, we prompted to reach out to all of these users and ask them on Slack, you know, are you still using this system? Why are you using it? Justify the need for it, and, you know, pre-program it to wait a day. If we don't get an answer, we remind them another day, and then we start, you know, lower the frequency, and, you know, make sure that we get increase the frequency until we get in the response. But, you know, we do that through Slack rather than, you know, go to the manager or something, that you do your employee need these accesses or whatever. And we found that quite effective. Another aspect is that when someone trying to onboard a new device, you know, they get a prompt, is this your device? You know, is it really your device? Like, yes, it's my device. And then we start, you know, providing the accesses. But if they say no, we block it. You know, and they have the opportunity to block if someone else has gained access to some of their credentials, they can, you know, actively block it themselves. So if we put security aside, which this have security benefits, of course, but if we put that aside, you know, this is basic IT processes. But I think automation really shines in this area.
One thought as you spoke, Darius, is around when things are not automated, actually people get annoyed of asking their colleagues 1 million times the same thing. So they're like, maybe we should have a training, or maybe we should change the way of working. But when it's automated, it's a machine. So 100 times to say it, or 1 million times, whatever. And then what's really important there, I feel, is somehow to be able to get the essence of it and understand what did the automation repeat too much, and that can be improved in the process. Because it feels like, and same with AR, right? If it's just, it can repeat as many times the same thing, it won't care. But maybe if it does at some point, it means that there is something that's not right, and that could create a monitoring of the automation as a new thing to do as well. Just an idea that popped up to my mind.
You were talking. Completely right. And, you know, with the all, you know, I've been putting automation on a pedestal here, and it's, you know, what you end up with is to have to monitor your automations, right? So you go from monitoring one thing to another thing, because you depend on them so much. So if they break, you will have other issues. So you end up monitoring your automations and how they work instead.
I like the idea of annoyance, though. Maybe that's what we need to build into the AI models. You know, if they repeat something over and over, they need to start getting annoyed and just answer more rudely. So,
I mean, whatever gets the job done right, maybe with a touch of cultural aspects to it, so we don't really become the bad guys only.
But it is, sometimes it needs to be thought also by, can I still do if it fails, right? You mentioned it. And back to resilience. If you have a problem, maybe automation is not the first thing you're going to put. So if the process is totally broken and Joe was just relying on resilience, the day you're restarting, that might be an issue or a hard point.
Yeah, I think automation, I don't think that you can run, I don't think you can run IT processes or security completely without automation these days. I mean, it has to be there. And I think that, you know, you have to increase it, because it's just the complexities are increasing. The, when you do things like add new functionality or spread out your infrastructure into more places, and it's just not possible to maintain it without automation. So I think it's growing sort of in parallel. And I think AI is kind of supercharged both ends of it. So it's increased the complexity, but it's also increased the amount of automation that you can perform. So I think it's growing fairly well in parallel right now. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where we go.
It's also a way for us to, you know, combat one of the, you know, biggest challenges we all have in terms of, you know, the skills gap in cybersecurity, and, you know, the shortage of people that you actually need on the team. It's harder to find, you know. I don't know, maybe you know this, Sophie, what's the average time to find a skill set that you need? It can't be less than 4 or 5 or even 6 months until you have that person on board, and then another 6 until it become valuable. And I think so what we can do to, you know, mitigate that, it's a must.
Yeah, you're totally right. I think it's not a quick amount of time, is it? It's not short. It can be quite long, even longer in some situations if it's something that's a unique skill set or difficult to find. Definitely.
And also many skills you don't need that often. You know, some things you just need to do sometimes, and you can use consultancy services, but you still have the overhead of getting them in and so on. And, you know, if you can get automation to do it, I think it can be really beneficial.
That's true.
We found a lot recently, some of our customers bring consultants in to upskill other kind of like full-time employees on kind of some of the AI stuff or the automation stuff. So it's almost like a skills transfer of, okay, we want to do this. You've done this before, come in very temporarily, and then we've got a process going forwards that hopefully then someone else within the team who's an employee there for a longer period can take over. And I think that's quite beneficial because you get the speed element as well as the long-term gain as well.
Yeah, I think like one thing on the automation, I think that, you know, if you combine it exactly with the right skills, but it can also help a little bit with upskilling. But I think that combining it with the self-service thought is not, at least I found it to be quite useful. And I like using my threat modeling example there, that, you know, you do a diagram, because as an IT architect, you need to do the diagram. You send it in and you get feedback back. You can act on the feedback, but you also see what was the thought process, like what was the process that this went through to arrive at these conclusions. And you can use that to, you know, with some skill, you can use that to find gaps or make it even better. And I think there are many areas where you can plug in AI, but the output doesn't have to be perfect. You don't have to get it all the way completely to the end. You have to make the response understandable enough for anyone with the right skill set to take on board and actually do what needs to be done and get the work done. So
Yeah, I completely agree.
Perfect. No, good. Another good topic. We've got a few minutes left, so we've got enough time for another topic, which was yourself, Bernard, on the war, whether it be Europe, the Middle East, and how kind of real life war can turn into cyber war. And I know this is something we discussed previously, so really interesting topic. Tell us more.
Yeah, I was actually discussing with a friend about all the activity related to the DDoS attacks that institutions are having in Europe and the ransomwares that are out there, etc. And then attacking hospitals, attacking these kind of things. And I just made the parallel in my head. I'm like, whenever there is during the war, you attack hospitals physically with the army and all. Of course, it's real casualties, and the whole community worldwide goes to say we shouldn't do it. I mean, we have rules, we have laws about it. But when it comes to cyber attack on a hospital, that can create the hospital to shut down totally. And then you have lives behind it as well. I mean, people who need care, etc. So the effect is maybe less obvious or less immediate on the patients, but still it's there. But there are no laws, no national or worldwide constitution about it saying do not attack hospitals. I mean, it's Sparta. You can do whatever you want. Of course, you're not allowed to. It's against the law to attack, but it's not condemned as strongly or at all, even sometimes. And this is what I was thinking, that things become more easy, or just to show, like, we are here, you took a political decisions, we are watching you, and we won't let you. I mean, Sweden joined NATO. The same afternoon, 3-4 websites from the government being down. So this is just amazing how fast things move, and also to show the pressure. And this is, I think, one of the first, it's been some before, but like the real cyber war with impact that people can see in the news. It has been some before, but it was like underground. Now it's obvious and it shows. And I thought it was quite interesting to make this parallel. I don't know. What's your take out on that, Neil?
I think it's a really interesting topic. I actually remember it was a keynote speech. I want to say it was Bruce Schneier. This many years ago. It was Black Hat or DEF CON, one of the conferences I was at. And he was talking about the rules of engagement for cyber warfare, that you have these rules of engagement for you know, you know that if a military from one country crosses the border to another country, you know you're at war. But in a cyber warfare, when are you at war? Well, no one really knows because the rules aren't there. But I think it was also about 10 years ago that there was an update to the NATO rules of engagement. So, it's been a while since I read this, but I want to remember that it said that if you physically harm someone, then actually the hackers in that case are a legitimate target. So there are some things coming in here, but the interesting thing is that I remember that conversation for about 10 years ago, and I remember these presentations, and then it's like almost nothing happened. And it just kept going, it just kept getting worse, but I never really saw a big debate on the rules of engagement, or, you know, what can we accept, what can we not accept from a nation state. And it's interesting to think about. I do wonder where it went.
And I would add that the war goes the other way. Like, anyone can be part of this cyber war. Now, just by TikTok, just by OSINT, so open source intelligence, people can see the troops moving. I mean, anyone can be a soldier, a digital soldier in the end. So that really takes those things at another level. I wish we would have never discovered them. But, I mean, we see that has turned. And that's where you see that there are no boundaries at all. And as you really mentioned, or duly noted, you don't know where the soldier is, where it starts, and where the war starts online, right? Since, it's and you can hide. It's not me, it's the neighbor.
And they're not even bound by national borders necessarily either. I mean, they're some of these groupings that are very active now in the war times are, you know, groups that just have a cause that's not really aligned to one state specifically, but they take the opportunity to act on the world stage now due to the war. But another aspect, which I think, I don't know if you notice it, but my threat intelligence feeds are quite littered with them, is like the amount of new modus operandi and, you know, TTPs that comes out now, because people are, or, you know, hacking groups are using them now actively for war purposes, and then they become known to the wider internet. And that itself is just a bit terrifying, because now we do get more novel means accessible to more, you know, antagonists to use against, you know, less, you know, regular companies or organizations.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting topic. And I suppose, I mean, all of the things we've mentioned on the kind of previous 4 or 5 topics could be almost podcasting themselves and kind of really deep conversations, because it's kind of never ends. But I think we've had a really good overview of many different things and some really good ideas and thoughts. I just wanted to say thank you to all three of you. So Barris, Neil, Bernard, on sharing your thoughts, sharing your opinions. And for anyone that is listening, obviously hope that you take something out of this podcast. And if anybody has any questions or wants to follow up, feel free to reach out to me directly. I can connect you with some of the panel members. And if anybody listening is interested in joining me on another podcast, please reach out on LinkedIn. But yeah, thank you to all three of you again. It's been a really good conversation. And yeah, I can't wait for everyone to be engaged and listen to it.